Celia Cruz.
Celia Cruz.
Mi nombre es Celia Cruz. Mi nombre es
Celia Cruz.
Celia Cruz. Celia Cruz.
Celia Cruz.
Ustedes están diciendo que...
WIOX is supported by Oakley's Wood Fired Pizza and Grill on Route 28 in Arkville. Respecting social distancing with inside and outside table service Wednesday through Sunday. Soup, salad, sandwiches, burgers, wings, and of course, wood fired pizza. Oakley's Wood Fired Pizza and Grill, 845-586-3474. 845-586-3474. WIOX is supported by CREA, a store designed as a source for sustainable artisanal products, including CREA's own jewelry made from reclaimed metals and ethically produced goods to wear and share. CREA, K-R-I-A, on Main Street in Margaretville. More information at CREAJewelry.com.
Hi, I'm Don Matheson, host of Vantage Point, heard every other Friday at 1 o'clock here on WIOX Roxbury. Live and local in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM and MTC Cable Channel 20. And everywhere at WIOXradio.org.
All right. You are listening to WIOX Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM and MTC Cable Channel 20, and everywhere at WIOXradio.org, where it's easy to donate if you like what you hear. You can also get WIOX on any smart device through the Radio.fm app. This is From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Talk about a different forest-related topic with Ryan and John. John, how's it going?
Things are good, Ryan. How are you?
I'm fine. Yeah. It's in the 30s, maybe upper 20s, and well within my range, you know. No wind. I like it.
I'll take it. Absolutely. This is comfortable winter weather.
Yeah. No, I like it. It's good working weather, you know. When it was high of 7 degrees, 20 mile per hour wind, not so much, especially when you're up in a tree.
Yeah, we were pruning apple trees, and that was really terrible.
Yeah, that was pretty cold.
Yeah.
But today's pretty good, and, you know, just been shoveling snow and loading the stove with firewood. That's about it when I get home, so.
Yeah, me too. I've been assessing my firewood pile. It's my first full winter.
You've been assessing?
Assessing.
Like clipboards and stuff?
Nah, just visually estimating.
Yeah.
Well, it's my first full winter at this house, so you never really know. I had half a winter last year, so it gave me a good estimation of what I think I needed. And, of course, I cut extra, more than that.
Yeah.
And I'm about half through what I cut and reserved at the house for this year's wood, but I have my extra stacked elsewhere if I need to touch my reserves, but I'm hoping to save those for next year.
Yeah. Yeah, that's where I'm at. I'm at half of what I thought. But, yeah, got another row in case.
You have to.
Yeah, you have to. You never know. And we're going to be entering some cold temperatures here on the extended forecast. It looks like this season for maple sugaring is going to be a quote-unquote typical year, March. Usually, I tap in mid-February, last 10 years or so, anywhere from January to mid-February. But it's looking like I might actually tap in March.
Whoa.
I know. And I'm not happy about it.
I know. Last year, I mean, you were done in February, and you were spraying dormant oil on your fruit trees by March.
Yeah. I like, you know, when you come home, it's still dark out, and you go in the sugar house, and and it's dark. But when you come home and it's light out, it's like you want to do other things. But to be honest with you, hey, you know what? I need maple syrup, so I'm going to have to do it in March. That's fine. Anyway, tonight's show is going to be something different. Quercus Cooperage with owner John Cox. And let me see if I can get him on. John, are you there?
I'm here. Can you guys hear me?
Absolutely, yeah. Where are you calling from?
I'm in Rhinebeck right now, but the cooperage is in High Falls.
All right.
So, we're down in the shadow of Mohonk.
Yeah, absolutely. I grew up in New Paltz on the other side of the mountain there. So
sure. Yeah, we're right in the gunks up here on the other side of the ridge.
Yeah, nice area. And are you from High Falls or are you coming from elsewhere? What's your tell us about yourself.
Yeah, I'm from South Philadelphia. I'll talk in my Philadelphia accent. That's where I learned the trade and I was a teenager and came up here via, I was in the city for a while, New York City, and then we came up here after 9/11 and I've been settled in here since, yeah.
And so before you got into making barrels and cooperage, what were you doing?
Oh, I started off doing woodworking, and I worked at this luthier shop, and they did antiques. And this was in the late 80s in South Philadelphia, and there was a lot of still local mill shops. You know, if you needed a door, you went to your local guy, and you made your door. And I worked for these two older Italian gentlemen in South Philly, and they taught me the trade. And I got an old-fashioned woodworking apprenticeship, one of the last, I think, and worked there and had my own shop in the early 90s and then made my way to New York City in the mid-90s. And we were doing custom high-end interiors all throughout the 90s and the aughts. And, we had a nice shop at our peak. We had about 13 guys. We did our own veneering and a lot of custom casework for the architectural trade.
Wow, doing your own veneering, that's tough work, right?
Yeah, so they wanted rift wide open. They didn't want any cathedrals or anything. They just wanted, like cat hair grain. So, you get good at it, and there's machinery set up for that, and there's even more better machinery now. But, so that's what we did. We controlled the veneer, and then we do these decorative pour fills called cherusing, so a decorative wood finish on oak. And, we were running with that for a while. And after 9/11, moved to High Falls, and I built a house in High Falls, a first-day cottage. I don't know if you guys ever came across any first-day cottage people. There's no sheetrock and no plywood. It's pretty interesting, that design. I've been working in High Falls and switched over from interiors and fabrication to the cooperage. We fabricated for a lot of artists, people like Wendell Castle and Robert Morris, and we did a lot of... we were on crews fabricating also for large-scale sculptors and artists.
Now, your office, or where you're out of at High Falls, is that up on the right as you go up Mountain Rest Road from High Falls? Or
that's it, yeah, that long white industrial building that you always wonder what's going on in there. Yeah, there's a water tower out back. That's where we're at, Mohonk Road.
What was that before? Yeah. Do you know the history of that building, or...?
The history is not great. It's getting better. Yeah, there was they were doing chrome plating and whatnot, and then for a while there was a large set design company in there that did stuff for New York City Opera sets and the NBA, and then they split it up and we got in there. We still had a cabinet shop up until 5 years ago in there. But it's nice. It's quiet.
Yeah, I always wondered about that. My wife owns a studio in Stone Ridge, so I go by there all the time.
Oh, yeah, you got to come in, man. I'll show you around. I got a huge collection of 18th and 19th century coopering hand tools, and just it's fun to hang out, and we'll char a barrel while you're there.
Yeah, absolutely. I go by there often. So what got you into cooperage? I mean, something that people just kind of stumble into.
It is not, and now I know why. No, but I guess about 6 years ago, I was looking for something different. We were doing custom fabrication for the interior trade and, running into the city a lot. And my friend said, hey, do you know there's a barrel shortage? And I was like, no. He's like, yeah, there's a barrel shortage. And you should look into it. You should make barrels. And I was like, yeah, all right. And but I started getting into it. And my interest was piqued. And I guess I slowly got obsessed, and I bought a bunch of barrels and reverse engineered them, took them apart and figured out, how it was made. And then I bought a large collection of the tools I just told you about, 19th and 18th century coopering tools from a museum in Ottawa that was deassessing their collection. So I got kind of like a whole coopering shop in a box. And that took me on a journey to figure out what these tools were and what they did. You know, most woodworking practices use the same tools. So if I was going to build you a kitchen or a staircase or a cabin or a dining table or, you know, a toy train, I'm going to be using the same sort of woodworking tools, planer, joiner, saw, router. But can you guys hear me all right?
Oh, yeah. You're crystal clear over here.
Oh, great. So the coopering is like boat building. It's very specific tooling used for that, and they aren't used for any other trade. So those tools really help unlock a secret because you could not find anything online. You couldn't find a YouTube video. You couldn't find a book. I mean, that got me even more intrigued. And I've had people would come to me. I talked to, you know, different people, and they would say, you know, God, I went online last night. You just can't find anything. You know, we could build an airplane if we wanted or a submarine from online plans. But so it was really a question. And then I also realized why there was a shortage at the time. My friend told me about there was this Time magazine article. And basically what was happening was that the craft distilling world, I'm going to call it craft distilling, and that's bourbon, whiskey, vodka, gin, that industry is federally mandated to use new charred oak barrels. So the American whiskey distiller can only use the barrel once. You guys following me on that?
Yeah, so, it has to be aged in white oak, right?
Well, yeah, new. So the words are new charred oak.
Right.
Okay, so they can't reuse the barrel. It has to be charred and it has to be oak. And this is because the government taxes them, state taxes and federal tax. And so it's regulated, just like tobacco. These things are regulated. It must be, to be called bourbon, it must be, you know, 8% this and 10% corn. And the proof, you know, is very standard regulations. And the last line of seven of those nine whiskeys say must be aged in the new charred barrel. So what you have happened in New York State and because of places like Tuttletown and Copper Sea and in Washington State, you have this boom in craft distilling.
Yeah.
But the barrel industry couldn't keep up with it. Most of the barrels at that point were coming out of the Kentucky area where the good old boys were like running the cooperages, and they thought it was cute that these New York distillers were opening. But all of a sudden, you have this boom in distillers, and there was a when I got in, there was an 18-month lead time on barrels. So the three of us were like, hey, let's open a distillery. Great, okay, what do we do? Yeah, you can't put anything in a barrel for 18 months.
Wow.
It's like, I guess we're making gin. You know, gin, vodka, tequila, those clear spirits aren't barrel-aged. So so it's a real problem, and it's leveled out a little bit now because other players have gotten involved. But at the time, there was a severe barrel shortage.
Yeah, I mean, the distilling, it's really only in the past few years, I guess, when New York laxed or deregulated some of their laws about using local agricultural products, right?
Right, because they see, you know, Cuomo loves it. It's agricultural, it's industrial, and then there's huge numbers of ancillary businesses like myself, the coopers, the labels, graphic design, packaging, distributors, you know, so it puts a lot of people to work. So it's agricultural at first, and then... And, yeah, it's great to see all these people come together. I mean, just I work with one of my biggest clients, a Stout Ridge Distillery in Marlboro. And, you know, the number of plumbers and electricians and, you know, the people who are installing the kilns and the systems and the solars, you know, just put so many people to work, set up these facilities. So, yeah, it's been great for New York State and Washington. And then, you know, it's spread out into Pennsylvania, spread all over the country. But New York definitely we're a little bit over 200 distilleries at the time, I think, at present.
Well, you know, I mean, I have an interest in distilling myself, and what I remember reading, I could be wrong, maybe someone correct me, but the reason why they went to the mountains to distill was to get away from the excise man to begin with, and it makes total sense because it used to be, you would distill where there's crops and good farmland, which was New York and PA.
Corn. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And as soon as that, it could have been after the Revolution when they had the whiskey, you know, they were taxing.
Well, exactly. So that's what Alexander Hamilton builds our economy on, taxing whiskey, taxing the farmers for their excess corn. That it quickly leads to the Whiskey Rebellion and tests up President Washington early in his administration.
Yeah.
And it's also why we have the IRS. Washington, they set that up so those guys could go collect the tax. But yes, our economy, to get us out of the debt of the Revolutionary War, was to tax the farmer and his alcohol.
Yeah, there you go. So, yeah, I always wonder why they're like stuck in some mountain hollow in, you know, West Virginia, Kentucky, Tennessee, whatnot. You know, it's kind of interesting.
All right, get away from the tax man and probably the family.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. So, you know, making barrels.
Stills would be illegal. So hold on a second. So that's an illegal still, right? If I set up one in your backyard, that's illegal, right? Because I'm not licensed by the government to produce alcohol.
Right. Yeah. Still to this day, I believe.
Right. But if MASH has taught us anything, it's a small still, at home still, it works well.
So you left the cabinetry business altogether then, right?
Yeah, I shut it. Yeah, we shut it down 5 years ago. I went into full production barrels, which is great because my main thing, too, was we were doing a lot of high-end finishes, too. So, one, we had a large spray booth room, a lot of chemicals, and all those custom finishes are pretty, but there's a lot of lacquer. So I was trying to get away from that, and the barrel was perfect because it kept me in my field of woodworking, and it got me away from the chemicals, got me away from the clients and the designers and custom fabrication and bidding on jobs like that. So, yeah, so that was how I started Quercus Cooperage. Now, a lot of things had to happen before we could go into production, and we can talk about some of the hurdles in opening a cooperage, one of them being that the wood, the white oak, the Quercus alba, has to be air-dried for at least 2 years, if not three.
Yeah, go into that for sure. It's so where do you supply it, and how do you get it? And I mean,
so I'm getting local logs. Yeah, so we have to use Quercus alba, white oak. As you guys might know, white oak, if any of your listeners are familiar with Mission Furniture or Arts and Crafts Furniture, white oak has quarter sawn white oak, has a distinct feature, which is called the medullary ray. These appear as sort of like diagonal squiggles, and Mission Furniture and the Stickley Brothers use it as a decorative effect. Now, those medullary rays in white oak make up about 38% of the mass. And in those medullary rays is something called tyloses, which you guys probably know about. And as the wood goes into late wood, those tyloses sort of balloon up in the cell structure, and that stops the passage of water from going through. So if I cut white oak quarter sawn, and for your listeners, so that means we're cutting the log into quarters, and then those quarters are then cut. Like it almost looks like a Trivial Pursuit puzzle piece. And the grain is taken out there. So I'm now putting the grain going perpendicular to the face of my barrel or to the face of my stave. And by doing that, stopping the liquid from running out. And it's only because of these tyloses and the medullary rays in the quarter sawn white oak. And that's why you don't see cherry barrels or mahogany barrels. Right. Well, it's oak because of its inner structure.
Now, what about other species that do that, though, like sycamore or sugar maple or something like that?
Yeah, well, maple is very hard to bend, but it does not have the tyloses, the high tyloses content that the other woods have. So I can get oak down to 1 inch, air dry it, and I can still bend it into a cask form.
The only question, question I have with white oak in the commercial wood business. Chestnut oak is sold as white oak, but you're going to say you don't use chestnut oak though, right? Right.
Well, I cannot use chestnut oak. I can't make a barrel out of it. I can use the chestnut oak, but it's not going to hold liquid. So the chestnut oak has a different pore structure, and I know I have a friend in Indiana who makes large tanks, and I called him because his supplier out of Indiana was calling me and was trying to sell me on his wood. And he said, so-and-so used to use me. So I called him and he said, they can't separate the chestnut oak out. So you're going to get a bundle of staves and you don't know until you build it what's chestnut and what's white.
How do you can't tell by looking at the wood in a stack then? Because as far as we've been told.
I'm sure I could do a loop on the end grain and tell. But, I mean, that's going to take me all day if I'm sitting there doing that. But I can control at my mill the difference between the white oak logs and the chestnut oak logs.
Yeah, because as far as we've been told in a commercial timber sale, that they get sold as the same
grade of lumber.
It does.
You know, where your timber sales, 85% of all that oak is going to one product. So I'll tell you. So 15% of the white oak landscape goes to flooring and the cabinet trade and veneer. And then the cooperage gets about 5% of that pie. But do you guys know where that other 85% is going? What product is making?
No.
The shipping pallet.
Oh, yeah.
About 85% of the annual oak timber goes to the shipping pallet. So in that, and most of that's knotty wood, right? It's not going to look nice on, you know, white oak veneer or a barrel. I can't use any wood that has any knots. So that's where most of it's going. So in the pallet world, they don't care whether it's chestnut oak or white oak. Same with like flooring also. You can throw some chestnut oak in there and it's not going to bother anybody.
Yeah, that makes sense. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Tonight's topic is Quercus cooperage with owner John Cox over in High Falls, Ulster County. So,
hey, everybody.
Let's back up for a second and tell us the significance. No, that's all right.
Yeah.
The significance of cooperage, barrels,
sure,
whatnot in American
mm-hmm.
history, you know?
Yeah, yeah, let's talk a little bit about it. All right, we're going to go back 2,000 years. Caesar is marching across Europe. The Holy Roman Empire is introducing Bordeaux and wine grapes into the Bordeaux region, and they're dragging all this wine around for the troops in these clay chimeras. That's like a large sort of long vase. It's got a nipple on the bottom that they can push into the sand. It has a narrow hole at the top so that the wine won't evaporate. When they get out into Spain and England, they're seeing these coopered vessels, these wooden columns that the Celts had made. The Gauls had usurped the Celts, and the Gauls had stole it. So when they get into France, they see these coopered vessels that had really been invented by the Celts during the Iron Age. So instead of using clay up there, they were using wood, banding it with steel rings. I've used the word cooper, and what I'm doing is I'm using what's called coopered joinery, okay? And that is by making a polygon by cutting a specific angle on the edges of the wood to make a specific polygon. I'm jumping around a little bit. We'll do the history, and then I'll come back to what coopering is. So barrel, by 3 AD, we see the barrel being widely used by the Roman Empire, and throughout the Middle Ages, it's used to age wine and to hold wine. And the Battle of Hastings, when France and England comes together and trade is opened after that war, we see wine going up from France up into England and back and forth. 200 ships a year would deliver wine and sherry up to England. That means you needed coopers there in England to take care of the barrel, to tighten them, to store them. So you have a whole trade is built up on this wine trade industry. It's now the 12th, 13th century, and we see coopering being used for kitchen implements, buckets, pails, butter churns, any sort of utensils that are being made. And we also see the beginning of nautical commerce from the Dutch Trading Company to the British Navy. And all these ships are heavily reliant on barrels for potable water, for food, and for their sailors are surviving, and also in the trade industry. They would put the staves in the boat and use it as ballasts. They would go down, let's say, to the Caribbean. The coopers would be making the barrels right there on the beachhead. They'd be filled. The barrel is easily rolled into a rowboat and put on the ship. And all of our commerce at this time is being shipped and traded in barrels. And this makes the coopering industry a very important industry.
And history. How about the local history?
Right. So as we see the Europeans come to America, we see them in Jamestown in 1604. They start building wooden pipes to irrigate water off the James River. Those wooden pipes are coopered joinery. Okay, it's like a long barrel on its side. We also know that the Mayflower is an interesting story. The Mayflower is 3 weeks late leaving England because nautical law says that you cannot travel without a cooper on board. The Mayflower was a decommissioned trading vessel, and the cooper was not interested in crossing the Atlantic. They found a young gentleman by the name of John Alden, and he was placed on the boat and came over. He was America's first cooper, and he was one of the longest living survivors on the Mayflower.
Wow!
And introduces coopering here into America. The reason they needed a cooper on board was because you have, let's say, there's 100 to 200 barrels below deck filled with potable water, salted fish, salted meats. these barrels have to be accessed and closed up. Okay, you know, like how are we going to get water out of a barrel? I can take a hatchet to it, but you know, we have to catch all the water. You know, there's no plastic or bowls or anything like that. So the barrel has to be closed and open properly and stored properly. Otherwise, everybody on the boat is going to get sick and possibly die. And there's reports of things like this. So it's very important, and it's why our ancestors survived these transatlantic ships, because the cooper on board. The cooper on board was usually the carpenter and doing sort of boat repairs, but he was taking care of the barrels and casks on board.
Yeah, I didn't think of that. Like, you know, if you're traveling long distances, like, yeah, without the cooper, you have no way to store anything for any amount of time.
Store anything or access it, right. And think about Captain Cook and the other explorers and the British Navy and all these conquering navies. They could not really kind of get anywhere without barrels. And, in fact, the pine tar that they relied on for the boats, for the ropes, you know, they don't have paint and varnish and glue back then. They have different tars and resins, and all that had to be stored in barrels. Hmm. They're also storing their gunpowder in barrels. Our ancestors, and we don't think about it a lot. I do a lecture kind of talking about this, how important it was. So let's get into the American colonies. Industries start to pop up. We have it in Jamestown, the tobacco industry. All that tobacco was shipped back to the king, and it was done in large wooden barrels called hogsheads. We have the whaling industry. The barrels are built right there in the hull of the boat. They're melting the blubber right there on the boat, and it goes directly into a barrel. There's a great chapter in Moby Dick where the coopers are putting the hot oil into the barrels, and they're chanting and singing. I think it's chapter 90 or 190. It's a great small chapter. So the whaling industry does not operate without a barrel. The tobacco industry. Now we have the cotton industry. The cement industry out of Rosendale, New York here, relied on the barrels. And then crude oil starts bubbling out of the ground in Pennsylvania, 1847, 1857, I believe. What are you doing with that oil that's shooting out of the ground? What are you going to put it in? There's no steel drums. There's no plastic. There's, you know, there's barrels. So at one point, John D. Rockefeller not only has the largest oil company, Standard Oil, but he has the largest cooperage in America, because he needs that cooperage to fill the barrels. Our area is very interesting also in our heritage because of the Livingston family and the Catskills. We know Chancellor Livingston. Your listeners might have heard of him. He was one of our founding fathers and helped write the Declaration of Independence and the Louisiana Purchase. Well, his father realized what the family owned, which was the Catskills, and what an important source of lumber that was, not only for the king, who wanted trees for masts and for boat building, but for the wood to build the local city, New York City, that was growing, the wood needed for buildings, the wood needed for wheels, the wood needed for cooperage, for furniture. Chancellor Livingston's father opens a mill up not too far from you guys on Route 28, and there's also a large cooperage there, and a town builds up around that lumber industry, and the town is known as Woodstock, and the cooperage was right there on the lake that is still called Cooper's Lake.
There must have been a lot of these cooperages, you think, right? I mean, they had to be pretty numerous, it sounds like, at one time.
They had to be numerous, yeah. That cooperage was mostly slack cooperage. So I can get into, there's three types of cooperages, and your town might have had more than just one. All right, we'll talk about tight cooperage. That's what I do. Tight cooperage is holding liquid. So it's holding whiskey, beer, potable water, oil, paint. You have slack cooperage. Slack cooperage is holding everything from tobacco, cement, salted fish, salted meats, glass, nails, eggs, pelts. Everything is being shipped in a slack cooperage. You also have a white cooper in your town, and the white cooper made utensils. We know utensils now as just forks and knives, but back then it was pails and bowls and bucket churns and spatulas and anything you would need in the domestic household that would be made out of wood. You know, there wasn't really a Target to go to buy a bowl or spatula, so you'd have a local cooper. So most towns would have many of these different cooperages there. Cement here in Rosendale went into a paper-lined slack barrel that would have 12 wooden hoops on it. They would send them to the city, and the men would crack them open and burn the hoops and the paper and the wood and use the cement.
John, Is there a hierarchy amongst you Coopers? You know, you look down on the white Coopers and the slack Coopers, or what?
I look down. No, well, there's no more white Coopers around. I mean, I am. I guess I'm a tight and white Cooper. That's also the name of my second rap album.
Nice. But,
no, look, I'm sure I'm a pest to these larger behemoth Cooperages. I mean, there's a Cooperage in Tennessee that makes 2,400 barrels a day. You can imagine the amount of wood that that takes. I want to get a little bit back to our area and what was going on, because there's another interesting aspect of this, and that's the hoopers. And the hoopers made the wooden hoop that would go around the barrel. So we talked about Rosendale Cement. There was even another large company in Kingston. If any of your listeners know the Ponchaki area, Ponchaki was a patrician town that was built up along this company called Newark Lime and Cement. They were a large cement company. They'd found these deposits of hydraulic cement in Rosendale and Kingston. And before the founding of Portland Cement, they really dominated the cement world. The Statue of Liberty base, the Washington Monument, the Brooklyn Bridge, Cassions, and, you know, countless other things in the city. But without the barrel, those industries couldn't go very well, and especially without the hoop. The Rosendale Cement Company did not want to be in the cooperage business. They didn't want to be making wooden hoops. So local farmers would take the saplings all year long and soak them in ponds. And then during the winter, when they couldn't farm, they and their young children would, on a draw bench with a draw knife, they would quarter the sapling and make wooden hoops. They would bring these wooden hoops to these companies like Newark or Rosendale and trade them at the local store. You know, the cement company owned the store and everything in town. So you would go there and trade for your linens or your other wares, your flour, and the hoops. A record show in 1881 alone, 55 million wooden hoops were made in just that year alone and sold to local companies. And a lot of these guys made more money than they did farming.
What species was used for those hoops, do you know?
I guess whatever was local, I guess it was hickory. I really don't know. It was probably whatever was growing. You know, they denuded all these hills here. When I say here, I'm in the Gunk. So, you know, they were all denuded from the iron industry and from the leather tanning industry. So whatever saplings were growing, I think there's some juniper. I think there's hickory, but I really don't know. You guys would probably know better than me.
It was good timing. Yeah. I mean, you have agricultural abandonment, and you basically get huge swaths of saplings growing up in those abandoned fields, and you know, hence enters the hoop shaving industry.
And also what happens too is that is the perfect environment for oak growth. The oak wants those sort of clearings done so they can come back, and because that's not happening now, because of fire suppression, you guys probably know this better than me, but you know, oak is losing its dominance, especially in this area, and we're seeing maple and poplars come in. But without natural burns, without these large clear cuttings, it's hard for oak to survive.
Yep, absolutely. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Tonight's topic is Quercus Cooperage with owner John Cox. We're going to take a break, but up next we'll ask John about Cooperage today, and we got plenty more questions.
I love you. promises. Why do I
That's Promises, Promises, just a good 1980s song that has nothing to do with our topic tonight on From the
Naked
Forest.
Naked Eyes.
Yes, yes, there you go. Naked Eyes. And that's John Cox. He's the owner with Quercus Cooperage. Yeah. You going to say something, John?
Yeah.
You hear
me? Yeah, can you hear me?
Oh, yeah. So
we're talking Naked Eyes tonight.
Yeah, it's a good song. So tell us about Cooperage today. Like, what, you know, I was reading an article, and that's how I found out about your business in the Bluestone Press. And
yeah.
Apparently, there's only 33 Coopers in the U.S. Why is that?
I don't know, because there's people smarter than me that decide to do something better with their life. No, we talked about it's a difficult thing to start. You know, the industry really atrophied not only at the turn of the century, but throughout the late 20th century. There wasn't much of a need. So there was a few people, you know, taking care of the Kentucky bourbon industry. And then there's a few cooperages in Napa taking care of the wine industry. But there wasn't really much need for anything else. So when I got in, you know, the industry had kind of consolidated into these larger plants, you know, these IKEA type. You know, there are giant campuses of wood milling and assembly. So, yeah, there just wasn't many small guys doing it.
Yeah, and I guess Prohibition in the 30s probably didn't help either.
No, it didn't. So what happens is you get corrugated cardboard at the turn of the century. If you know the Dumbo neighborhood in Brooklyn there, that was a huge hub, making like 90% of all the corrugated cardboard at the time, the Robert Gare industry. So corrugated cardboard changed everything. Then you have the shipping container, and then definitely Prohibition was sort of the death knell. And a lot of these, you know, it really put that aside. You know, some of these larger breweries, you know, had their own kind of cooperages in-house. So when a lot of these larger breweries got bought up by other larger breweries, those cooperages would go away. The Vassar Brothers in Wappingers Falls had a large cooperage connected with the brewery there, where they were making, you know, 50,000 barrels a year. So that was what a lot of the cooperages were sort of in-house, if you will.
So let's talk about the tools.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, you know, I read a book on oak. I can't remember the author's name. Listen, I don't know anything about woodworking. John knows about woodworking. But the guy describes it as an art. It's not just math. It's a very – something you almost have to – kind of feel when you're putting a barrel together. I don't really know if that's true, but let's go through the process of this.
Sure. I'd like to think of this more as like a Jedi trick, because we're using the Force.
Yeah.
So let's talk about coopering and what it is, okay? So cooper joinery is creating a polygon using angles on the edges of the cut. And a picture frame is a perfect example of Cooper joinery. It's four pieces of wood connected with a 45-degree angle, right? You guys following that? So that's Coopering right there. And the way that number is found is a rudimentary mathematical equation. I'll lay that out here, okay? We want to create a four-sided polygon. And we're going to imagine that polygon inside of a circle, 360 degrees. So if I divide 4 into 360 degrees, I'm going to get the number 90, okay? Is everybody following me? Everybody home?
Yes. Yeah.
And I can make a frame using 90-degree butt joints, right?
Yes.
If I take that number and I divide by 2, I get 45. So if I put a 45-degree cut on each side of the wood, and I have four pieces of wood, doesn't matter if it's a rectangle or a square, I'm going to have a four-sided polygon, right?
Okay.
So 360 divided by the number of staves divided by 2. And that's the same for a silo, a hot tub, a water tower on the Upper West Side of New York City, a barrel, or any other Cooper joinery. And we see Cooper joinery used in the woodworking field in a lot of places. Wood turners use Cooper joinery. If you ever see any wood columns out front of a home, that was usually 6 or 8 pieces of wood that have been glued up and then turned on the lathe. And we see it in other woodworking aspects, like I talked about the picture frame. So there's a lot of Cooper joinery going on, although it's not all called Coopering. So that's what I'm doing. I'm utilizing that joint, and because it's one of the ancient trades, I'm named after what I do. The millers milled, the sawyers sawed, and the Coopers used Cooper joinery. If you have a Cooper Street in your town, that's where the Coopers was. If you know anyone named Cooper, that's what their ancestors did. In Germany, it's Fassbender. In France, it's Tonnerre. Somebody just told me, I think it's Kruger in Germany, but Belgium, but I don't remember. So anyway, so it's an ancient trade, and that's what we're doing. We're coopering. So I'm creating now a barrel using 25 to 30 pieces of wood with an angle cut on the side, and I found that angle by that same rudimentary calculation I told you guys. Am I making sense so far?
Yeah. Why was there never another type of joint used? I mean, some type of stronger, self-standing joint that didn't require a ring or something like that.
Well, you didn't need to require the machinery and a motor and a spindle and a cutter head to do that, right?
Right.
But I can make a straight cut using a rudimentary axe and what's called a Cooper's jointer to give me that angle and put together. And if this is my profession, and I've been doing it since I was a kid, and I've been doing it for 40 years, I get pretty good at it. So, and you're also starting to introduce, what are you going to do? You're going to do like some sort of tongue and groove, and that's going to snap, and then how are you going to bend it? You know, you can't bend two pieces of wood that have been tongue and grooved. But you can bend two flat pieces of wood that are just butted up against each other.
How do you account for swelling in the wood when it's filled with something liquid and all
we
that?
Do account for that, and these barrels are designed to be filled with water. We want the water and the bilge of the barrel pressing against the metal rings that are pushing it down. Let's talk about what the barrel is, okay? We talked about the angle and what Cooper joinery is. Let's talk about what the barrel is. And the barrel is a series of staves, and a stave is a long stick. If anybody can imagine a barrel and blow it up, right, it's made of these vertical sticks, and each end has what's called a barrel head. And that's the flat head that goes into the barrel there. And then there's metal rings and rivets. That's really all that the barrel is. So our stave is quarter sawn white oak. We talked about that. We talked about the angle that's on the edge there. And we're going to raise a barrel. And when we raise that barrel, it almost looks like a skirt. Can everybody picture that? The barrel is just sort of flared out. When I steam that wood, I'm steaming the lignin that's in the wood. Did we talk about lignin earlier?
No.
Lignins, you guys probably know better than me, but it's a sort of gelatinous material that's holding the wood fibers together, the structure. That's why a tree sways in the wind, and it's why you can't snap a wet branch. You know, it just sort of bends. That lignin, when I heat it up and steam it, allows me to bend the wood into the shape of a barrel. This is why Cooper has to use air-dried wood. Most wood is put into a kiln at 600 degrees, and that crystallizes that lignin. It lowers the moisture content, but also crystallizes the lignin. And that's great because your dining table doesn't warp and your kitchen door doesn't warp. Sturdy's the wood. I can't bend wood that has crystallized lignin. No woodworker can bend kiln-dried wood. It just snaps. This is why boat builders also use air-dried wood. The boat builders are bending the oak to keep the water out. The coopers are bending the white oak to keep the water in. It's the same sort of trick there. So we're going to steam the barrel so that I can put a cable around it and pull it together and cinch it into the shape that we know as a barrel. And that barrel is bent because it has a bilge in the middle. Okay, if everybody can picture a traditional barrel, it has a fat belly in the middle. We call that the bilge. The reason the barrel has that is so one man or woman can roll that barrel, let's say it's 900 pounds, can roll it by themselves, can turn and pivot, and then roll it up the plank of a ship, because these were relied upon because we were doing nautical commerce for, you know, 2,000 years. So the barrel is very important. The bilge was very important. Coopers also make tanks, something like a water tower or a hot tub or a silo. And those staves don't have any bilge, okay, if we can imagine a hot tub. It's the same thing. It's a series of long pieces of wood. There's a head on one end, but that hasn't been bent. Everybody following me so far?
Yes.
I'm just listening. This is good stuff, man.
Okay, so let's take an American football and unstitch it, okay? And what we're going to have is four pieces of leather that are sort of a roughly diamond shape, right? Everybody picture that? As we sew those four pieces of leather together, we start to get this polygon that has a bilge in the middle. As we get to the end there and stitch it together, it comes to another point. We've created this vessel that has a bilge in the middle. And if we were to cut the ends off American football, we'd basically have the shape of a barrel. Now, those four pieces of leathers are shaped like a diamond. If those four pieces of leather were just rectangular and I stitched them together, I'd have a sleeve or a can or a tube. So that's what the tank is. The tank has a stave that has no bilge. And the barrel has staves that swell in the middle and then have the bilge. Is that making sense?
Did it take time to practice that bilge? I mean, that's quite an art, I would think.
Well, you know, remember, I bought a series of tools from the 18th and 19th century. I did not try to reinvent the wheel. I didn't try to come up with a better way to do this. I didn't go to my buddy's shop that has a CNC machine. I looked at these tools and said, what did this guy do all day? And how can I do it on my mid-20th century cabinet-making tools? But I didn't try to change anything. I did it exactly the way they did it. It's been going on for 2,000 years. I don't have CNC equipment, nor do I want it. So I had to approach it that way. So, yes, it was very hard. It's still hard.
Yeah.
But the bilge is sort of easy because I've created a stave that's symmetrical. That football goes together because those pieces have been cut accurately. You know, this is all math. That barrel comes together because of math. You know, the head fits in there because of math. So I've always enjoyed math, and I play music, too, which has a lot of math involved. So I knew that if I trusted the math, and if I figured out how these tools work, I could make it work. I guess I was right.
So it sounds like you've done this before, not only the barrels, but educated others about it. So do you host educational events about making about cooperage?
I do. I have like an hour and a half presentation. I do half on cultural heritage and history with great slides, and then the other half is my process. We do Q&As, but it's been very hard with COVID. You know, I had 200 people in the Woodland Pond elderly home in New Paltz right before all this happened, so I don't know when the next time I'm going to be surrounded by 200 people in a nursing home. But yeah, no, I do. I do lectures, different historical societies, and I'm to hire, and yeah, I give a rollicking good talk, and then I'll usually bring a little whiskey that came out of one of the barrels. We can all taste it, so it's fun for everyone.
Yeah,
I'll bring some of the tools, too, and show them. And it's a fascinating history. And look, our all of our ancestors, whether you were from Japan, Belgium, or Bulgaria, all of our ancestors relied on this wooden barrel for potable water, for food, for transportation, for commerce. It kind of unites us all together. When you start peeling this onion away, you see how reliant, like, not only industry was, but even just the day-to-day regular folks.
Was there any regional differences in the making or the process?
product? There's regional differences in different countries. I mean, they basically used what wood they had. You know, in Japan, they're using shugi. And, you know, in Bulgaria and France, they're using their types of oak, you know, Quercus, Sicile. You know, here in New York, at the tip of the Appalachians, we still have oak. You know, if the Coopers landed in the Adirondacks, I'm not sure what they would be doing if they wouldn't have much oak. But, yeah, the other thing is when the Europeans came over here, they loved the American oak because it could be milled. The French oak cannot be like sawn. It has to be split, and eventually they can saw it. I really don't know all the ins and outs of that, but they did find that the American wood, the wood that was here in the colonies, milled easier and better.
Okay.
So that was a fascinating thing. So, so I'm trying to keep this craft alive, myself alive. And, you know, I've dabbled, I don't know how much time we have, but, I've been dabbling in the culinary world and making what's called open-top fermenters. The craft spirits industry, up until Prohibition, relied heavily on open-top fermentation. They didn't have copper or steel back then. So there were these large open tanks that they could add the yeast to and create a biome in there of the wort and the beer to then distill. And there's a lot of people who want to do it that way, and I've been making tanks for that industry that they can ferment in. And that's gone into the world of Japanese cooking and shoyu and soy sauce. And that world relies heavily on wood. In Japan, these guys were making these large tanks with braided bamboo rings, and they would put the shoyu in there for a year and age it. And my brothers, those Japanese coopers, are using the same rudimentary math and rudimentary tools that I'm doing. Just the wood's different. And it sort of ties us all together.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest. Tonight's topic is Quercus Cooperage with owner John Cox from High Falls, Ulster County. John, we only got about 5 minutes left. And,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, I want to, you know, you run
Sorry,
a forest.
I barely talked all night.
No, it's been great. you know, you run a forest-based business. I just want to ask you, what are your greatest, you know, benefits from doing that and challenges?
The benefits are, you know, I've been a woodworker since I was a kid, and I really enjoy it, and I do enjoy the coopering because of the lack of, you know, the chemicals, and I'm constantly being pushed. I'm being asked, can you make this, can you make that, there's a cooper, oh, can you make this, and so because of my background in custom fabrication, I sort of jump right in. You know, some of these other cooperages are great guys, but they're set up, you know, it's automated, and they can make barrels, and that's pretty much it. What did you ask me? What are the challenges?
Yeah.
Well, the challenges is finding oak, because the Scots, God love them, are buying up all the stave mills and the distilleries. They recently bought Tuttletown Distillery here, and so they are making it a little harder for a little old me to get my wood.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm competing, you know. When I was a cabinet maker, we would never fight like we were competing with IKEA, right? We either had clients who wanted IKEA or wanted something custom made, and you know, those two didn't really mix. But here I find myself, you know, sort of competing a little bit more, at least for the supply chain.
Yeah, we've had several shows on oak and why it's going down. And like you said, there's a lack of forest management in many ways. Yeah, I don't see it coming back in New York State anytime soon.
Yeah, if you go to my website, I wrote two articles for a magazine, American Spirits, and I did a two-part on oak regeneration, talked to some people who were doing controlled burns here in Mohonk, and some other people who were doing some good work at Cornell, and we talked about why it's happening and what people can do and local townships can do to bring it back. And those are on my website at qcooperage.com.
Yeah. You need sunlight, and, you know, you have deer as well, and there's a lot going on there. We call it the
This industry is not really sustainable. I mean, the fact that they can only use it once, you know, that is a, I mean, there's a huge secondary market for the barrel, but it's not helping the oak supplies by creating something that people can only use once.
Yeah. Well, John, you have any questions?
Real quick, I want to know how long it takes to make a barrel and how many make per year or per day or whatever.
Yeah, so I have rudimentary machines. I'm doing it by myself by hand. So, you know, the numbers show that I could make 20 a week, you know, if I had the supply chain and we were all really cranking and making the rings. We make our own metal rings, too, and we rivet them by hand. So, you know, good weeks, I'm making 6 to 8 a week, and I have somebody helping me with the rings. If I had, like, 3 guys in there and we really had the wood, I could do 20. But, again, I'm on rudimentary mid-20th century, you know, furniture-making machines. I'm not automated. So, you know, if I had $2 million and we got some machines from Europe, we could go a little faster. But for my, you know, honest little thing, I can do about 6 to 8 a week.
Yeah. No, it's hard to find barrels. I remember I was looking for some a couple years ago, and it was not easy finding, especially smaller sizes at
right.
the time.
Yeah.
At
well, you got to call your local cooper.
That's right. I didn't know about you.
Yeah. Yeah, no. We're trying to get the word out.
Yeah.
It was great having me on, guys. I would love it. You guys are welcome to come by the shop anytime. We're right there in High Falls, or any of your listeners. You can reach out to me. I'm on Instagram and Facebook. The website's qcooperage.com. And, yeah, I love talking barrels with people.
Absolutely, yeah. We enjoyed it. And thanks so much for coming on.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me. It was great.
Yeah, thanks, John.
All right, take care.
Take care.
And if you missed the show tonight, it was Quercus Cooperage with owner John Cox. And he's in High Falls, Ulster County. Didn't know about his business there. Now I do. And that's pretty neat.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, when we can do educational events in a big way again, I want to do something with him through Catskill Forest Association and take people there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. And do a little tour there. But that's about all the time we have on From the Forest. And I don't know. We'll have to do another show on oak regeneration again and the importance of that at some point. But that's all the time I got. You got anything, John?
Nope, that's it.
All right.
Have a good night, everyone.
Have a good night.
Oh, the neon lights were flashing and the icy wind did blow. The water seeped into his shoes and the drizzle turned to snow. His eyes were red, his hopes were dead, and the wine was running low. And the old man came home from the forest. His tears fell on the sidewalk as he stumbled in the street. A dozen faces stopped to stare, but no one stopped to speak. For his castle was a hallway, and the bottle was his friend. And the old man stumbled in from the forest. Up a dark and dingy staircase, the old man made his way. His ragged coat around him as upon his cot he lay. And he wondered how it happened that he ended up this way. Getting lost like a fool in the forest. And as he lay there sleeping, a vision did appear. Upon his mantle shining, the face of one so dear, who'd loved him in the springtime of a long forgotten year, when the wildflowers did bloom in the forest. She touched his grizzled fingers and she called him by his name. And then he heard the joyful sound of children at their games. In an old house on a hillside in some forgotten town, where the river runs down from the forest. With a mighty roar, the big jet soars above the canyon streets. And the con men con, but life goes on, for the city never sleeps. And to an old forgotten soldier, the dawn will come no more. For the old man has come home from the forest.
Is supported by Tito Bad Tito's Cascade.